Hi, I'm Krish Ashok, author of Masala Lab, The Science of Indian Cooking, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, a conversation with the author of Masala Lab, The Science of Indian Cooking, Krish Ashok. Stay tuned. As always, thank you for listening to the show and for rating and kindly reviewing and following on social media. It's very much appreciated and I'm truly grateful. So do you ever have that ultra cool teacher who just found a way to simplify the most challenging concepts? You know who they are because they're always just superb at taking complex and dense knowledge and often through storytelling and offering contextual background, help you synthesize it into retainable information. And at the end, students and learners are often left mesmerized by a new lesson and are eager to share this knowledge because it's compelling, memorable, and most importantly, fun. Now, this is exactly how I've felt when I'm watching and learning from Krish Ashok, the author of Masala Lab, The Science of Indian Cooking. Ashok is an engineer who leads the advisory and consulting function of the AI cloud unit at Tata Consulting, which unto itself, by the way, is quite cool and noteworthy. But it's his deep curiosity and exploratory nerdiness in the kitchen that led him to research, experiment, develop a working expertise, and share culinary knowledge with others to make for better cooking and turn the kitchen into a joyful playground. Now, Indian foods lives at so many different intersections and is anything but monolithic. And so Ashok artfully weaves elements of history and the tradition of our grandmothers and physiology and local culture and nutritional and medical science into thoughtful and playful storytelling that ultimately helps provide a rationale for the many intricacies of our food. When reading his book or watching his terrific videos, naturally there's a lot of aha moments involved for everyone, including those that Ashok had himself in his own journey of exhaustively testing, confirming, and myth-busting his way through Indian food. What's disarmingly impressive is Ashok's discipline for using scientific reason and curiosity to help guide a very subjective experience like food, especially that which often plays upon our feelings of nostalgia, comfort, and adventure all at once. So it was really great to catch up with him for a conversation about everything from food identities in India to how his time in the US informed him to irritating misconceptions to AI and fact-checking. But I first wanted to know, given his background and curiosity, if he finds himself constantly thinking of questions when he's eating a meal.
So in a sense, I've compartmentalized it by saving all of the curiosity and the food science and the really dissecting and deconstructing to when I eat like new novel food, typically at a restaurant or at somebody's new place or a chef who invited me and so on. But for home and comfort food, I very willingly just do it in a very completely different. I'm not really thinking. I'm just really just enjoying what it is because it's, for the most part, when you're eating comfort food, it's you're just experiencing nostalgia rather than anything novel in a culinary sense anyway.
Well, and, for you, does comfort food then take on a little bit different meaning then where you're, really have to respect that?
Yeah, no. So to be fair, I think as part of this entire research into food, I've kind of broadly started to appreciate how insanely sort of, shall we say, subjective and fallacious we tend to be when it comes to opinions on food, right? And we so regularly and flippantly end up insulting somebody else's comfort food. How can you like that? It's an overrated dish. But it also means that I think we all experience food in such a deeply individual way based on our upbringing, based on what we grew up eating when we were children and so on. And in India, what I found is that food habits therefore become very central to defining your community, caste, religious identity. So all the taboos, so we are as much defined by what we don't eat versus what we eat. So for me, comfort food has a slightly different, there are multiple versions of comfort food for me. So, obviously the food that I grew up eating as a child, as a South Indian vegetarian, but obviously the comfort food that I grew up eating as a teenager when my friends would take me out to Old Delhi and eat kebabs. You know, my sort of first exposure to eating meat and so on. And again, I think lived for 7 years in the US, so Mexican food kind of became comfort food because it's living in San Antonio, Texas. And over time, that kind of became tacos and other things sort of became comfort food as well. So it kind of varies based on context, yes.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, that bridge of nostalgia and new experiences and what they mean at the time, like, you know, eating something from your grandmother's kitchen and food definitely is going to be slightly different, but maybe in some way just as comforting as the Tex-Mex you're getting along the Riverwalk. Yeah,
absolutely. It's just repeated behaviors, and also I think the memories, because I think the physical location, your grandmother's presence, that is actually part of the flavor memory. People often don't sort of appreciate that, yes.
You mentioned you grew up eating Indian food, and I actually appreciate how you mentioned, you know, just as important are the memories of what you do eat and actually also what you have omitted in linking with some of these kind of food identities, if you will. But when you grew up eating Indian food, when you started to really dissect and explore and translate the experiences and actually the science behind it, what did you personally perhaps need to unlearn? And even just to start the process of really thinking about this in a more deep way?
I think it took a fair while. I don't think I was well and truly an adventurous eater or a foodie well into my 30s, in fact, right? Because these are very hard to unlearn. And particularly, I think, in my case, coming from a conservative vegetarian household. And, you know, it also comes with this added baggage of not only are we vegetarian, but this is superior, right? So this is the way we cook it is superior, right? So the spices we use is better than some of the more intense spices somebody else uses. So in India, there's a lot of this sort of, you know, we're better than them sort of constant jockeying. And food is often a very central way in which people sort of demonstrate that because they know that food memories and nostalgia is the ideal way to keep someone in the tribe, if you will, right? And so I think first sort of experience, first learning is that given enough time and experience and the ability to just simply try other things, it's possible to make something entirely foreign comfort food as well. You just have to give it enough time, right? And as a teenager, you know, you're hungry all the time, you know, and you are, you know, your friends are taking you out to Old Delhi and so on. The first time around, it's, you know, you're just taking a very delicate bite because you just want to be with and you don't want to stand out from your friends and so on. That peer pressure eventually kind of helps you experience and build memories for a new set of flavors. And eventually the meta idea that, look, you can keep doing this again and again, right? It's just a matter of going through that, all the mental block the first time. But then eventually you recognize that whatever it is that you're so uncomfortable with is literally food for millions of people, right? So clearly it cannot be bad for you, right? I mean, unless you specifically have allergies related to, say, shellfish or something else. So I think that you'll unlearn a lot. I mean, and it's not just in food, right? I mean, you know, I grew up as a Carnatic classical musician. We were told that that's the greatest kind of music. Film music is terrible. And you kind of slowly outgrow that as you grow up, yes.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, yeah, you're right. Unleashing sort of new ideas, particularly in adolescence and then in your young adulthood, whether it's musical taste or food taste, in some ways kind of embracing that these ideas, even though they're so ingrained, you probably had to let go of a lot. And you probably had to, I'm sure, take the idea that this is the best off of that pedestal. Yeah. And did that allow you to, I think, ask those questions a little bit better then?
Very much. So in a sense, I think another, in my particular case, as I got into high school and as we were starting to learn physics and mathematics and going down the STEM route and so on, it also struck me in a sense that I took to physics and mathematics more naturally because it allowed me to break everything down to first principles in a way other subjects often do not, right? At least before. I've always had trouble memorizing stuff. So for me, this natural idea of therefore bringing it down to first principles and then trying to see if I can then reassemble that complex chain of reasoning at the end using these first principles, Lego bricks, is a practice that has, in a sense, really helped me, for example, get down to writing this book and, you know, making the videos that I do and applying it in, you know, in my career in software or for that matter, learning music or for that matter, this meta skill of picking up new skills really rapidly, right? So in that sense, I think a lot of in cooking, it's the same thing, right? You sort of you quickly realize that there is tacit wisdom in how your mother cooks, because she's learned it from her mother, and there's a sort of unbroken chain of knowledge that's sort of come down. The practical heuristics of when is rice cooked, right? How do you make a soft chapati? Or how do you ensure that the dal is not too thick or not too watery? And how do you ensure that you get the perfect browning on something? And they do this without necessarily understanding the Maillard reaction and temperatures and pH and all of that. But understanding it using pH and Maillard reaction and the state changes and other things and thermodynamics, in my opinion, makes that knowledgeable far more universalizable, right? As opposed to you being able to learn it only by being mentored by a mother or a grandmother and using that traditional Indian diktat, just do what I say, don't question it, right? So I think amidst that, you sort of then learn that, look, most of what your grandmother said will work in the kitchen. Most of what your grandfather said about health and nutrition, probably not, right? So my general rule of thumb is that ignore grandfathers, listen to grandmothers.
I think one thing that you mentioned there really resonates, for me at least, as a medical educator. You know, you ask some people how to do something, they could certainly show you, but they couldn't explain it. Exactly. And that's what absolutely makes them, in a way, unconsciously competent, right? And from what you're describing, there's a big difference between unconsciously competent at what you do and someone who's very consciously competent, because they could probably dissect it out. They could really explain it and to great detail in that way too.
Exactly. And it sort of goes back to Daniel Kahneman's System 1 and System 2, right? I mean, you actually want to get good enough at something so that you let System 1 do this on autopilot. Otherwise, it would be cognitively exhausting to sit and turn every little trip to the kitchen into an engineering project, right? Yes.
That's right. Yeah. You know, you mentioned earlier these kind of food identities that we find so much of in India. And in some ways, I've heard you speak a little bit about this, where, you know, the concept of Indian food itself is, you know, such an amalgam of so many different pieces and textures and different ideas. With so many of these kind of tribal food identities that are out there across India, do you personally identify with any of them? I mean, do you find it hard to have a home in this space?
It is hard. I mean, obviously, I don't want to shy away from the fact that, so I obviously, growing up in a South Indian vegetarian household, so that is comfort food in that sense. Growing as a teenager in Delhi and eating kebabs as well as dal makhani, roti dal, has also become comfort food. Living in San Antonio has made Mexican food, you know, comfort food and so on. But within India, as I've kind of grown older, I've been sort of researching this book. I actually ended up, you know, being into data science. I ended up downloading like 100,000 recipes and, you know, writing some Python code to look at patterns and so on, right? Before I wrote my book. And I kind of recognized that despite all these differences, there are some common patterns that emerge, right? In that, you know, fundamentally, if you choose a particular fat that is local to a region and a particular set of spices, and that is your tadka, if you will, right, at the start or at the end, that really defines the flavor profile of any region more than anything else. Right, so you could take the same recipe, and if you just change the fat to coconut oil and use curry leaves, garlic, chilies, and cumin, it will taste Kerala no matter, you know. You could take a Maharashtrian dish and just make it Kerala by just changing the fat and the initial spices or the tadka that you add. So if it's mustard oil and panchfuran, that's going to make it Bengali. If it's ghee and a bunch of spices, you know, Punjabi, right? And again, and you could really go micro. I mean, in Vidarbha, cottonseed oil is very much used because it is and you would have sesame oil used in South India and so on. So in that sense, there is a set of commonality. But amidst that, as I got really, really interested, so for me, if you really tell me, my two favorite Indian regional cuisines are Maharashtrian and Bengali, right?
I've seen you talk about this as well.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So I find that one is that I think these are two cuisines that use what we now call negative flavor pairing, which is that they use ingredients that don't necessarily share flavor ingredients more often than not. So it's more of a party in the mouth, but also more interestingly, there are more variations in textures, right? You know, you look at Maharashtrian food, there's always something crunchy. There's a crunchy element in anything, even the simplest dish. Even in how you chop vegetables, is there, people pay attention to giving you a textural contrast, a spice contrast, a sweet and sour contrast. And again, I think in the context of Maharashtra, I can imagine, I think, and Bengal as well, right? So these are fusion culinary cultures, right? So one is that Maharashtra sort of straddles North and South India, right? These are two broad culinary traditions. And I think there's a little bit of both in Maharashtra, right? And Bengal, obviously, I think it's the Bengali and the Mughlai influences that kind of come together that make it truly, truly fascinating. Yeah.
Well, this definitely explains some of my Aji's banana, tomato, and peanut yogurt dishes for sure.
Yes, yes. You get the crunch from the peanut, you get the glutamates from the tomato.
That's right. That's yes. right. And I love this idea, of course, of there's so many different, even local, you know, you go 50 miles and the flavor yes. profiles might definitely change with just within a region itself. Yep. You mentioned the sort of American experience and what you got from being in San Antonio for a few years.
Yes.
From that time, I mean, you know, the comfort foods, of course, live with the time and the nostalgia of what you experienced when you were here. But from that experience, and especially living abroad and outside of India, how did this experience maybe inform your understanding of some of the various food intersections that you currently examine in Indian food itself?
Okay. So I think my single biggest positive takeaway, you know, I think Indians sometimes come to the US and then are immediately like, it's just processed food. It's just, you know, it's right. not, doesn't have flavor yeah. and so on. Right? Because again, we're just so strongly obsessed with our micro cuisines that literally anything else is going to be bad for you. So for example, I later found out that the average American spends about like half an hour in the kitchen. The average Indian spends close to 5 hours. I think there's a story there in the sense that, yes, on the one hand, you ostensibly say it's about cooking everything fresh, making everything, making like five dishes from scratch for every meal. So that said, I think my biggest takeaway from the West was that it's possible to prioritize convenience. Because I have a lot of people in the US, a lot of people in Europe eat absolutely delicious food while not taking 5 hours to prepare it. So,
right.
In that sense, embracing the refrigerator, embracing the freezer, embracing, you know, conveniences like pre-cut vegetables.
Microwaves
and air fryers now and many other conveniences. I think that is something that I took away. And as you sort of come back to India and you're like, now you're frustrated that why are these people sitting and slaving away in the kitchen, you know, when they could be using some of these appliances. Yes.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with Krish Ashok. Stay tuned.
Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. This is Sid Sriram, and you're now listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi, this is Farhan Akhtar.
Hi, guys. I'm Ananya Pandey.
Hi, this is Madhuri Dixit, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with the author of Masala Lab, The Science of Indian Cooking, Krish Ashok.
You know, from that idea, the positives of actually using the element of convenience, were there elements also that, you know, made you actually appreciate Indian food that much more because of some of the profiles and patterns and things that you observed or even experienced when you were here?
Yes. So clearly, I think one is that the nutritional balance of a lot of Western food is sort of where the protein is the start of the show and then everything else is on the side, right? I mean, you know, there's a piece of steak, there's like a chicken breast, there's a fish, and then everything else is on the side. I think one obviously is that you could say that in many cases, India is kind of on the other extreme, which is that the carbs are the center of the show and then everything else is on the side. But I think, you know, what I started appreciating about a typical, potentially well-balanced, but still reasonably minimalist Indian meal gives you more dimensions of flavor, texture, tastes, you know, side, visual sort of appeal and so on than a lot of the average sort of industrialized ways in which, you know, people eat food here. I was stunned by the very fact that in my home, in my mother's home, 5 days of the week, you're going to eat at least 10 different vegetables. And I found that most supermarkets won't have 10 different vegetables, right? That people eat, let alone, yeah. Right? And different kinds of gourds and different kinds of pumpkins and different kinds of... So the sheer... And the fact that most people also comfortably know how to use them, right? And to make both minimalist as well as very, very sophisticated dishes with them. So in that sense, I think if anything that struck me was the vegetarian cuisines of India are not an afterthought like they are in the West, where you make meat dishes and then you replace the meat with a meat substitute or something else. But the vegetarian traditions in India are an entire rich cuisine by itself. And I think you really, really begin to appreciate that when you try and eat vegetarian food in the West, at least in the past. It's a lot better now, but yes.
And so much is made in the West and definitely worldwide, yeah. When it comes to rating things, right? The subjectivity of it goes so much. And I've asked other food experts this before, even on this program, but you know, when something gets awarded, say a Michelin star here in the West, and there's rave reviews about something, and same thing actually in India too. Yep. I mean, is there just a crowd psychology mentality that somehow this is better, and you know, the street food that you get is any less delicious? Is, you know, are we just Yelpifying our way through the food experience here?
Absolutely. I mean, despite being someone who's sort of big on social media, but you know. Barring the fact that it's helped us discover, you know, recipes, and you know, you could go to YouTube and search for anything, and I think that's a fantastic thing. But I think social media's impact on health, nutrition, and on discoverability of restaurants and things, I don't think has necessarily been a positive thing at all. I think it sort of turned us. For starters, I think, you know, people have to recognize that Michelin star was originally for farmhouses, you know, a restaurant that were far outside Paris, you know, they forced people to drive and wear out their Michelin tires, right? So it was never given to restaurants that were in Paris. It sort of changed much later, right? I mean, you have to remember that the goal of many of these things were fundamentally different originally. And then they took on a life of their own. And social media, what it ends up doing is that if an influencer says, this is amazing, you got to go here, right? One, that person's probably not telling you that he's been paid a lot of money to just put out that organic post that makes it seem like that he just chanced upon this restaurant and so on. It's never the case. You're almost always being paid for it because there's lots of, you know, money at stake. And because, you know, these restaurants, you can suddenly, if a big influencer says, you know, just post a photo of them eating at a restaurant, there's going to be a big queue of people, you know, waiting to eat there and so on. There's a weird dynamic in India now where if you see, there's millions of viral videos of street food people doing atrociously crazy things, like making a 30 egg omelet and grating like half a kg of butter onto some melting, you know, onto that. None of that's basically heart attack on a plate that nobody's actually eating, but they're happy to make it because there's a bunch of guys with gimbals, you know, who've descended on that place saying that, bhaiya, aisa banao, please make it like this so that, you know, he makes a viral video, right? And it's a weird thing. And that person is like, he's poor enough to the point where he knows that he's getting attention. It doesn't really matter. All, you know, all PR is good PR in this case. So it ends up creating this artificial sense of, oh, this is a scarcity thing. It'll be very hard for me to get this. So I really, you know, as Anthony Bourdain says, in most situations, street food is actually far more likely to be tastier and healthier than many of these middling restaurants, right?
From what you do on social media, and I think some of the benefits of it, it's also to debunk some of these things, right?
Absolutely,
and As someone who really has devoted a lot of energy and effort to making sure that data and science is accompanying maybe some holistic things that are out there, and also really myth-busting in a way, as you've put it before, I'm so curious for you, do you actually have more fun when adding layers to a fact or to actually debunk and expose a fallacy?
I enjoy doing those creative science history and you know, those sorts of, you know, things that you didn't realize, kind of trying to explain complex science and that's what gives me joy. But it's the debunking that gets you eyeballs. Let's be absolutely clear, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so, and it all, in a sense, it's sort of, it's become sort of like a social service, if you will, because, you know, hundreds of people will keep asking me, right? You know, is this true? Is this true?
Right.
And I'll eventually say, fine, you know what? 100 people have asked me, so fine, let me debug this formally, right? Because otherwise, I'm just simply going to keep getting that for the next week or so. But yeah, right. So it's really not fun because, again, I think the problem is that it takes very little effort to, you know, craft some bullshit and scare people. But it takes more than 90 seconds to debug, unfortunately, right? And so the hardest job here is somehow picking the things that the largest layperson audience will understand from the point of view of debunking, which therefore means you're going to leave out some nuance, right? Which therefore means that you're almost always going to come across as, oh, this person is anti-Ayurveda. I am not, right? I am just against this influencer telling you that you must never eat a strawberry milkshake because it's toxic, because Ayurveda said fruits and milk must not be mixed, right?
Right. Correct.
And the problem is many of these guys now give you seemingly scientific reasons because they have recognized that the public responds well to people who sound sciencey, right? And they, for example, somebody recently said that, fruits are high in citric acid and strawberries high in citric acid and that will curdle the milk and that's actually bad for you. I'm like, your stomach pH is 1.5. It's going to curdle milk.
It's going to curdle there anyways, right?
Have you seen a baby vomit? That's curdled milk. So what are you worried about? And so on. Right? And so, but then what people will say is that I pointed out this little fun fact because I know it will resonate with the audience. But somebody will say that I'm lactose intolerant. Many people are lactose intolerant. Your response is not sensitive. I said, I cannot possibly cover lactose intolerance in a 90-second video while we're speaking about somebody claiming strawberry milkshakes are toxic. Yeah, so I think, that's the problem, yes.
It is, and I agree with that in so many ways. The other part of what you said, that it's what brings you joy, is that it sounds like particularly when you are really kind of weaving through the history. And
yes.
I particularly remember one of your videos talking about colonialization and Rava.
Yes. And the Pav Bhaji one. I really enjoyed that one. Yes. The
Pav Bhaji one. Bhaji. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the joy there is probably through a lot more of the storytelling.
It is.
Right. And the myth busting is more of, trying to just get rid of the nonsense. That's out there.
Absolutely. Yes. But yeah, but I think the problem is that the social media algorithms are kind of optimized for conflict, and if they're designed for somebody to say nonsense and for you to react to that nonsense, right? And it's a terrible way to. In an ideal world, I don't mind having a half an hour conversation with these people who make these videos, while willing to point out that, look, three or four of the things you say, I can counter, right? But I'm sure you're a good person who broadly has good advice to give to people. I think that's not the world we live in, right? So we live in this, X and Instagram antagonistic world of, reaction videos and so on.
You know, with your, in many ways, kind of global lens, having traveled and, have had some background in the States and, of course, have spoken in so many different places, are there misconceptions about Indian food, whether they're based upon myth busting or even just these cultural notions, but which of these misconceptions do you find absolutely irritating? Yes. In that, boy, it really is just like, boy, when I hear that one, it really, really bugs me to no end.
Yeah. Yes. So I think my favorite one is that, let's eat Indian, right? I mean, what colleagues would say is
right.
Right. What? Bengali or, Kerala or Chettinad or Kungunad or, right? So it's like saying, the next time, I sometimes tell my, colleagues in Europe and so on, let's go eat European, right? They'll be like, what do you mean European?
Right.
Like, European food, right? I mean, saying Indian food is about as silly as saying European food. And I would argue there's more culinary diversity in the subcontinent than there is in the entirety of Europe. So in that sense, I think, one is that sort of, the second sort of realization is also that, even if you kind of know if you are truly an aficionado of Indian food, the idea that naan, paratha, butter chicken, and now to some extent dosa is now therefore just basically definition of Indian food. And I think for people to appreciate that more so than anywhere else, there is a difference between a home-cooked Indian food and restaurant Indian food. So restaurants are not in the business of taking your home-cooked food and presenting it to the world. They're not. They're an engineering business that is focused on making things in the shortest amount of time at the lowest amount of cost in ways that you can prep ahead. Right? A dal makhani at home is a 9-hour affair. A dal makhani in a restaurant is literally 5 minutes, right? Which means that the dal is already cooked and is the makhani gravy. Combine both together, slap some butter on it, and you're done, right? So I think, and for example, there's a Maharashtrian dish of remarkably elaborate dish of slicing bhindi and then stuffing it with this sort of crunchy peanut spicy thing and then slow roasting it till it is so it net to net it would take you 45 minutes to make. Never, you're never going to find that in a restaurant because that's, you can't automate it, you can't pre-stuff it and keep because it's not going to work, right? So I think the recognition that Indian food is more than just what you get in restaurants is also I think beyond just the diversity. Even if you have a South Indian restaurant and a Bengali restaurant and a North Indian restaurant, even that does not capture the diversity of what Indian food is. And I think the other, my other thing is Indian food is spicy. And I often want to point out that, no, it depends. You know, so if you say spicy from the point of view of using aromatic spices, yes, that describes North Indian food.
Yeah.
But if you are spicy in terms of the use of chilies, that's just heat. Yeah. That's more South Indian food, right? And so these are very entirely different sensations.
No, I love that because again, even just the concept of restauranting in India is, you know, in the grand scheme of the historical perspective, a relatively new one.
Very, very.
And good. you just don't get that kind of diversity. You know, to me, one of my irritating things is that just, you know, we're going to have an Indian flavored dessert, so let's just add some mango. I mean, what kind of mango? Which mango?
This is... You know, but Brazil has mangoes, yes.
Yeah. Philippine, you know, the whole thing. So,
yeah.
You know, I interestingly had hosted an entrepreneur here in the Bay Area named Nikhil Abraham, and he's someone who co-founded an enterprise called Cloud Chef. And the interesting part of it is that they use AI to actually help recreate dishes from around the world.
Nice.
And I'm curious what you think about this in that, do you think that this kind of tech and computational data-based gastronomy has actually a role in steering us towards better choices or a more holistically physiologic harmony, especially when it comes to Indian food?
I absolutely agree. There are many, if you sort of look at the macro issues about food in India, for all of its amazing food and so on.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that I think still half the population is probably undernourished. The rest of the population is still eating a very imbalanced meal in terms of very carb heavy. And then you have the crisis in agriculture, which is also sort of meaning that you're getting fewer and fewer minerals and micronutrients from your vegetables and so on. As India is modernizing and as, you know, as men and women both go to work, I think the diet patterns in terms of what you eat, more processed food, more restaurant food, you know, which means more fat, more salt and sugar is also increasing, right? So with that, you're sort of seeing the rise of metabolic diseases like, you know, the diabetes and obesity and heart disease and so on. And the historical sort of resistance to applying any modern day nutritional science and food science. And for example, the number of Indians who fail to recognize that if you are not Haryanvi Punjabi, there's a good chance you are mostly lactose intolerant as adults. You just don't realize it. People just naturally reduce their milk consumption. They switch to, you know, things like yogurt and, you know, curd and so on, which is sort of less on lactose. But then there's tons of other myths related to you must not mix milk and meat. You must not mix milk with this. All of these things fundamentally, in my opinion, come from not understanding that you're probably lactose intolerant and you built all these other things around it to even figure out a way for you to sort of adjust and manage that. So I really think a couple of things. One is that AI and data will play a tremendous role in capturing heuristics and traditional ideas about particular cuisines purely from, say, a video or a recipe that someone shared on a blog, right?
Right.
And represent them in richer, deeper ways, right? Particularly for cuisines that are underrepresented, like Odia cuisine, like Assamese cuisine, right? Or Gondi cuisine and so on, right? So clearly, I think that's going to play a tremendous role simply in being able to create a knowledge base that is richer and so on.
Yeah.
The second thing is that it is absolutely going to help. I would ideally imagine a world where, like with personal genomics and highly personalized, like if I have a like an interesting personalized map of my gut bacteria, my genetics, can AI design a meal for me or a meal plan for me that will work for me, right? I know that tech will come. I know a lot of Silicon Valley tech pros will claim that they already have it. And I also know it's probably not going to work right now. It will take a little bit of more science before it actually gets there, but we'll get there, right? I also feel that AI can play a significant role, generative AI can play a significant role in also applying actual culinary and food science in helping people experiment better.
Yeah.
Right. Right now, it's not there. You know, I asked ChatGPT for a Bengali sweet dish that also features meat. And it just made up Rasgulla meat curry. I was like, what? why would you do that? So but eventually I think, you know, for example, if I can thoughtfully, with underlying understanding of flavor mixing and others, generate like a fusion Thai South Indian recipe, for example, if you give me a recipe for a Thai biryani, for example, my book has a carefully thought out version of how you could make a Thai biryani, right? But layering Thai flavors, Thai jasmine rice, and, you know, the way they do it. And you could still make a rice dish that is layered like a biryani, but has Thai flavors and so on. So I really think the novelty, individual novelty part will also play a tremendous role.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with Krish Ashok. Stay tuned.
Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, this is Cal Penn. I'm an actor, author, former public servant, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tam France.
Hey, this is Samir Gadia.
Hi, my name is Richa Morjani, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Hi there, I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with the author of Masala Lab, The Science of Indian Cooking, Krish Ashok.
I really love the idea, particularly of AI and its role in preservation. You know, so like preventing some things from becoming extinct.
Yep.
And as we know, there are so many things in India that purely exist in oral or family tradition and
Languages, cuisines, right? You know,
everything,
even books, right? Many things are just oral. They're not being written down. Yeah.
You know, I've heard you say that embracing the scientific method does not have to come at the cost of our cultural identity. And that being said, you know, with that in mind and with what we just talked about when it comes to the almost power of this computational data and in food science.
Yes.
What do you think today is the biggest threat to, again, quote, Indian food as we know it in 2024?
A couple of things that I broadly see is that one is, so this is a first generation of India that is coming online and at scale, right? You know, like serious scale, like a billion people scale, right? And I think in a weird sense, like we've seen with social media and other parts of the world, you're starting to see the darker side of what essentially trying to give a bunch of, you know, young people this platform where they have these loudspeakers in a country where you've largely grown up believing that your way, your house's way, your community's way, your religion's way, your food, all of that has, you know, social status that's above everybody else and so on, right? All of a sudden, people are now forced to encounter diversity. What I see is that I think a lot more people have trouble embracing this true diversity. So it is very unique. So it's only in India that you will find that there'll be a 75-year-old lady, you know, a grandmother in Kerala, whose, you know, grandson would have come from the US and put a camera and said, hey, make me this beef dish that you've always made for me, right?
Right.
And I should just see the amount of hate comments that will come from random North Indians who have trouble with somebody 2,000 kilometers south of them, you know, eating what they've eaten for thousands of years. What I find is the biggest threat is this instinct towards homogenization, right?
Mm.
One national language, one cuisine, one culture, only vegetarian, only this. And I think that is and there's a certain sort of sometimes dovetails into the current political climate as well, right? So people are also confident about looking at a Bengali person or a South Indian person and saying that your food is like, you know, tamasic and so on. Who gets to decide what is tamasic? Who gets to decide that fish is tamasic and so on, or garlic is tamasic and so on? So I think there is a, when you combine social media and give it to, it's like a lit fuse and a grenade to a population that is already so fragmented with all of these ideas of superiority and caste and community and religion and polarization. I don't think that's a great way for people to actually appreciate the true diversity of India, the other kinds of food, right? You then end up with products also signaling very similar things. You end up with restaurants saying pure vegetarian. You end up with restaurants saying no onion, garlic. Right? You end up with restaurants also advertising not beef, but buff. There's a very unique Indian thing. Right?
Yeah.
It's the menu literally saying, hey, this is buffalo, not a cow, right?
Yeah.
And it's very weird, right?
Yeah.
But it will take, I think, a little bit of more maturity for people to get comfortable with how incredibly diverse India is. And I think social media is in a weird way against this kind of celebration of diversity, especially in a place like India.
Mm. Yeah. You talk a lot about, and I think it's such a dynamic contrast, right? You have this democratization of knowledge and power and, you know, something that someone can capture in the palm of their hands through their phone.
Yep.
And yet, again, there's still psychology of,
exactly.
of all those things that you mentioned, right?
Exactly. Right.
And yes. especially for Indian food, there's a 3-4-dimensional matrix that really involves history and geography and language and regionalism and religion and and politics and economies and sociology, and the list goes on and on. When that's all at play, how then do you integrate the rich nostalgia that we started this conversation with that innovation and respect to diversity in a way then that is safe and natural and still healthy and can be very protective of the population, you know, without, again, all of the kind of threats that we just talked about?
I think it's, in a sense, economic growth and prosperity, more secular economic growth, meaning that across different segments of society, if the economic growth and the opportunities are even, and today they're not, right, in that there's, I think the top is growing faster than the middle, and the middle is growing faster than the bottom. You're going to exacerbate many of these kinds of things. Because, you know, regardless of that, right, so, you know, in India, right, there are deep economic divides and class divides, but everyone has a smartphone. Right. So everyone gets to give death threats against somebody eating beef or somebody eating, you know, something else that they don't like, right? So in a sense, I really think one is that I think we've social media tools have got to build better ways of moderating against this kind of, you know, amplification of hatred. It's not hard at all, right? It doesn't take that much smart. It's an incentive system that you've got to sort of change. And I also think, as I said, we don't see this as much of a problem when people of multiple religions, communities, castes, etc., come and work in, say, a software company, right? It doesn't completely go away, but it's a completely different environment from, say, the Indian village, right? You know, where it's all you see, all those things are in sharp contrast. Like, for example, people are far more likely to go to a restaurant and eat what they want to eat, right? Very few people are saying, no, I will not come to a non-veg restaurant. The social pressure of being professionals, as it has done in the US and the West and many other parts of the world, actually forget the US and the West, as it has done in Southeast Asia and East Asia, which are far more culturally closer, and just maybe 30, 40 years sort of lead time in terms of economic development and industrial growth, you get rid of some of these other, the worst of some of these tendencies, if you just simply have more people have more opportunities and so on. And I think that combined with social media really embracing better designs to incentivize creativity and diversity as opposed to conflict and sensationalism.
Yeah, boy, that sounds lovely. You're someone who evangelizes the prevention of echo chambers. And I think what you just talked about sort of speaks specifically to that. And to constantly raise questions, right? Yes. So for you who, you know, you absolutely help fact check and you help myth bust and you also help promote storytelling with food, who fact checks you?
Yeah, this is a fantastic question. Yeah, yes.
Yeah, who serves as your kind of guardrails and questions your, you know, appetite for giving education?
This is particularly important. This is because you know, it actually goes back to the title of your podcast, right? Trust me, I know what I'm doing. I would actually argue it particularly is a problem in India. It's a problem because we're a culture as a result of the specific history of colonialism and then the first, you know, the first 70 years of independence, 80 years of after independence and so on, with broadly very weak institutions and so on. What that has meant is that Indians instinctively trust individuals, not systems, processes, and institutions. So that's why all the obsession with Godmen and people will take health advice from a Bollywood celebrity, right? And people will take, you know, health advice from a cricket player, right? And so on, right? And to that extent, same thing. Me, an engineer, not a qualified doctor, not a qualified nutritionist, people will take medical and nutritional advice from me and demand it.
Right. Yeah.
Of course, I'm you know, absolutely careful to say, sorry, I have no qualifications to advise your individual. What I post is just broadly published science. It's science communication. I'm not a nutritionist or a doctor and so on. And yet, it goes into the thousands. People will say, but I don't trust doctors. I trust you. Right. I said, then that's a problem.
Right.
He said, no, but I don't trust doctors because, you know, my parents, you know, my father went through this surgery and we just lost all our life savings and he eventually died anyway, right? And so I have no trust in the medical system. Sure. Of course, many people have suboptimal experiences with modern medicine, right? Ayurveda and Unani and Siddha are usually the first line of medical care for the vast majority of the population. So I'm always like consciously aware. There are two levels at which I want to sort of keep myself honest. One is that I almost always am open to people who do serious science, who tell me that, yeah, I appreciate you're doing this in 90 seconds, but here's what you're missing, right? And here's a caveat that I think you should have added. And that's always useful information for me, right? And then I almost always then end up adding that caveat at least to the text description or the caption. Not that people read it, but at least try and keep that in mind the next time going forward. So that's one from serious people of science who there's always a tension between science and science communication, right? And storytelling and so on. Right?
Of course.
And you sometimes have to use a metaphor that the scientist might get uncomfortable with saying that, no, that person knows that area so much that he knows that this metaphor probably breaks down in these exceptional areas. But I am not in the process of communicating a PhD thesis to an audience. I just want to get them curious enough about science to build a healthy skepticism for against you know, some of this bullshit, right? The second category that I've now started to do is to also kind of try and understand why people believe the things they believe, right? I am now consciously aware when I call someone out and say, this is absolute bullshit. I know tons of people go and leave very angry comments on that person. I know it's having a negative impact on their mental health. And I don't like that at all. But I cannot possibly tell, you know, a million people who follow me to not do that. And some people just will, right? And they see themselves as, I am now armed with all the tools Masala Lab has given me and I'm going to beat everyone, you know, on the head with it, right? So as my wife says, my book has been the single biggest enabler of men mansplaining their wives and mothers in the kitchen, right? So, so to that end, I'm particularly keen on understanding why people believe what they believe. And the only way you can do that is if you can understand the Indian way of thought, right? Be it the Hindu or the subcontinental way of thinking about things, the belief in the supernatural, belief in some of these other things, belief in Ayurveda, belief in some of these other meta models, if you will, right? And that's why I sort of said, you know, even somebody like a Devdutt Patnaik, that's why I said, you know, hey, you're a mythologist, I'm a mythbuster, right? So maybe we should have a conversation about food and this. And
yes, I saw that.
It was, it was a 3-hour conversation. I said, let me milk this, you know, one video at a time. It was a very, very fascinating sort of conversation. But but I think I also have a few Ayurvedic physicians in my DMs, right? Who I absolutely let them say that, yes, I know you're calling this out, but by the way, right? You know, this is how we do this. Right. We don't, actual practical people do not believe in all this sattvic, tamasic bullshit. Mm-hmm. We regularly tell our patients that if the patient is a meat-eating patient, we don't tell them to eat vegetarian food. So all of this is social media nonsense. Right. So I'm absolutely open to hearing what the other side is. And the other thing is that I also want to keep telling people, again, this is the lazy way out, right? It's to say that please do not assume everything I say is correct, right? I will make mistakes, right? I'm probably relying on some dubious research. I'm sometimes maybe citing a paper that maybe the sample size wasn't great. Maybe it was just a, right?
Mm.
And maybe I'm using very poorly done science in the last 5 years to debunk something that might have been tacit wisdom from 2000 years, right? So Taleb's, Nassim Nicholas Taleb, that look, hey, you know, there's a lot of bad science. Okay. So don't throw out heuristics and tacit wisdom just on the basis of poorly done science as well. In a sense, I think the deeper issue is I really want to tell people that don't trust me blindly, right?
Yeah.
Right. I hope all you take away from me is some thinking tools that allow you to ask the right questions and be skeptical. And if that's, you know, if that happens to a fraction of this audience, I think then they end up, you know, the network effect of that is really what I want, rather than people to, you know, blindly trust me. I would absolutely happily get back to people and say, hey, you know what, I was wrong about this, you know, and so on. So yeah, so I think it's an emerging thing. The social media incentives of social media make it very hard to do that. And so on. And people also get very upset if you change your mind. Right? That's another thing that happens. Oh, yeah. Right? But you told me 3 years ago this was okay. I said, yeah, I changed my mind because the science changed. Right. Or I learned better. Right? And yeah, so it's a very tricky thing. I try my best.
Well, it's a tricky thing. Not only you're trying your best, but you're bringing so many people into a conversation about food and why it matters and really enlightening so many out there. Ashok, thank you so, so much for this. This was really a wonderful treat, and I hope we might be able to visit with you again down the road sometime.
Absolutely.
And please check out Ashok's work on YouTube and social media, and links to the book are in the show notes. A big thanks to you for rating and reviewing and passing the word along to your friends and family about Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.